Misty, your comment about busyness increasing taken into account. I do hope that some of us have been able to take time this week to appreciate and enjoy the greening of the world. It is a marvelous thing that happens in this part of the world at this time of the year, where the room where I speak to you from has a large window to my right. I can look out that window at almost solid living green things this morning. And man, it feels good. Summers here might be short, but they are wondrous living examples of change and of new life, of renewed life. And I think sometimes taking a moment just to look closely at or touch a fresh bud or a leaf or a blossom, those are ordinary things that most of us can do. They take a moment and they can renew our sense of wonder and with it our sense of hope. And I think that's huge. And I should say also that something like that, taking that kind of a moment, that's not something we do in denial of world events. That's not something we do to put down or put away the things that trouble us. It's something we do to remind ourselves that what is happening in the worlds that we make and culture, that all of that stuff takes place on a planet we didn't make. It all happens in a context that is expansive and ancient beyond our imagining. And that's important, I think, because it can help us with perspective. It can help us resist the inclination to think that in the end, this is all about us, when in fact, even the most important things that happen to us or around us take place in a much larger, much older story, one that started long before we were here, and one that will continue after we're gone. And just to be abundantly clear, when I say we, I mean humanity. I do not mean any particular people group or holders of any specific beliefs or adherence to any particular idea of what that story might be. All of that, for me, also suggests that things like land acknowledgements, which are part of our practice as a community, remain helpful and hopeful. They're not a panacea, they're a reminder. And one of the beauties of, for me, of recalling regularly in the context of others, of community, that the land on which we gather, when we gather as a community, is Treaty One land in this part of the world, that it's a continent, a bunch of plates floating around in the sea, that was already well occupied by humanity and by a group that I think could be characterized, and I welcome correction and expansion on this from our Indigenous friends and family, but a people group that had a profound sense of humble place in and with the land. I think that the connection to a greater story was a very vibrant and remains a very vibrant part of that culture, as far as I can tell, as someone not from that culture. And I think that's important for us to recognize too. Helps us again have a bigger sense of place for current events. Now, I do not know how those ideas sound to you. Maybe they sound fatalistic or even passive. To me, they feel liberating because they suggest that I can both imagine and make choices that aim toward future outcomes that I may well not be around to see or to experience, but that still have a meaningful place in that longer arc of history. And that helps me to keep my sense of meaning and purpose more intact, less fragmented, and less dependent on the immediate, while also freeing me to act now in ways that are hopeful about a better future. So, yes, there's some tension in those ideas, isn't there always? We're going to come back to some of those themes shortly, but I would like us to take some time to breathe together first. If you're joining us for the first time in this community in this way, or this is not a practice that you feel at home or at ease with, just a reminder that it's always an invitation to participate in this, not an obligation. This is not a sorting basket for in and out. It's just an opportunity to do something together that I hope will be helpful to us all. I would invite us this morning to breathe for someone that you know, that has a knee of oppression on their neck. A phrase that was recast brilliantly, I think, as part of the eulogizing of one of the deaths in the U.S. this past week. And if you don't feel like you know someone that has a knee of oppression on their neck, then I would invite you, as you breathe, to consider how that might change. So, if you know someone by name, maybe go there. And if you don't, there's certainly also plenty of systemic examples that can come to mind. But let's breathe together. Four cycles this morning, if we will. In through your nose, cradle your breath, out through your mouth. And I would invite you this morning, as you breathe, in terms of other embodied ways of being mindful, to simply take your hands as you breathe and bring them together slowly over the course of those three cycles of breathing until your fingers are deeply interlocked, as a way of reminding yourself with your body of how interlocked we are as a species, as human kind. As human kin. All right, let's breathe together. Thank you. I don't expect that it was audible on the microphone I'm using, but as I mentioned before, part of our pet Mika's routine these last few months as we've been doing this in the mornings has been that she joins me in this room and just loves to be with her humans, and so she settles in and has a nap on the couch behind me while I talk. Turns out that that's more or less the same thing that Rosa does. If you plunk her down in front of the TV during this part of our gathering, as soon as I start to talk, she just flakes out and stays there until I stop, and then she wakes up. So if what you feel like you need most in your life is a nap, this might be the perfect time right here. I've been struck in a new way lately by the power of words. It feels like this pandemic has flooded us with catchphrases, with these reoccurring groups of words that seem to touch on some aspect of our shared experiences, that in such a way that they keep recurring. Those phrases keep coming back and keep returning to them. I don't know about you, but it didn't take me long to kind of get tired of some parts of that. And it seems like I may not have been alone in that experience. This past week, one of our kids sent around a screenshot of a Twitter feed. And I'll soften some of the adjectives here a little bit, just in case you don't feel like explaining F-bombs to your kids this morning. The feed starts with a tweet that says, "Remember precedented times? Those bleeping ruled." And that was followed up by subsequent tweets that said, "I also enjoyed charted territory." And then one that said, "And a scarcity of caution." And the feed was capped with a post that just said, "Foreseen circumstances." Indeed. You could probably add some of your own. I think part of the reason that I'm noticing all of this is because, at least more acutely, is because this community has been interacting more online, which means that our exchanges have more often involved, you know, writing, posting things, that kind of interaction. The kinds of things that involve sharing words in a way that stay visible, such that they can be returned to over and over again more easily. And that also means that they can be shared with others with just a mouse click, which is kind of incredible, and that those others can share with still more others and so on and so on. You know, that post went viral is a short sentence about a mathematically and culturally remarkable thing, which is the power of sharing something with someone online. As our ways of interacting with one another in the online world keep evolving, it feels to me like it's getting more and more important to try to have some metaphors for the internet that are about its impact and not just about its functioning. And the one idea that has been coming to my mind most often these days is the metaphor of amplifier. Zach, you used that idea in what you were saying this morning, which is intriguing to me. For the past month or so, this household has been dealing with internet service issues. And with three people in the house working from home offices, that has occasionally verged on the very local version of crisis. Now, part of that process has involved measuring signal strengths and trying to find ways to amplify them. Now, this past week, it seems like we pretty much got that sorted. So just to be clear in sharing this, I am not looking for advice or technical support. I'm just illustrating an idea. Anyway, one of the things that that we did as a result of that was amplify our internet signal. Amplifiers, of course, are simply things we could think of as things that devices that make things louder, that make things bigger. So let's say if you have a small desirable signal, let's call that good internet service for now, and you want more of it, then you amplify it with a little, it's called a drop amp or a line amp. You just put this little device in the middle of the signal stream that physically in the middle of the cable that just makes the signal that's in it bigger. Now, the problem is if the good frequencies, the good internet frequencies that you want and need are in that signal, and so are the bad ones or the interfering ones, the problem is that you can't amplify one without amplifying the other. And so now your good signal is more robust, but the racket that surrounded it is louder as well, and they cancel one another out, and what you end up with is either a situation in which you're constantly getting kicked out of Zoom meetings, the local crisis, or you just have no usable signal at all. And all of that got me thinking about ways in which the Internet of Things can amplify both the gems and the junk, such that they can end up basically canceling one another out or leaving us with the sense that there's nothing usable there at all. And I know that we don't tend to default to that as a community. I mean, Zach, again, your list of helpful podcasts, for instance, was an illustration of ways in which we can filter that. So it feels to me like that's important. The filtering is important. We need a filter. We need some way of sorting out the useful signals from the interfering ones, of separating, you know, the beauty from the bilge water, or the songs from the static, whatever images we want to use. Maybe at least as a way to get us musing a little bit further about this, we could say that we need a way to separate the wisdom from the platitudes. That's sort of the picture that I'm going to work with this morning. And I should say before I get into any of this that personally I think that any idea that starts out with only two categories is headed for trouble. Anytime we treat those categories as absolute, if we turn it into some kind of non-negotiable sorting system in which one category is always right and the other category is always wrong, you know, I think we're headed for a not helpful place. No part of life, it seems, will settle into something that simplistic unless we're complicit and or okay with being willfully blind to our own limited perspectives and prejudices. And if we haven't been reminded vigorously enough of how that's problematic this past week, then perhaps we are not open to being reminded. We'll come back to that before we're done this morning. But let's start with the difference between wisdom and platitude, because it can sound very similar when we actually hear them. And that's part of what makes it a little bit of a hazardous thing. We might feel like we know this already because ideas like platitude or wisdom are common in our everyday lives. They're common words in our everyday speech. I promise not to talk about the Latin of either of them. But just to see if we can have some shared terms to get going, here's a couple of short definitions. So for platitude first. And this is, by the way, a Wikipedia definition, as you will probably be able to tell by the end, because it moves from sort of what we might call shared or commonly agreed upon understandings to something a little bit editorial. A platitude is a trite, meaningless, or prosaic statement, often used as a thought-terminating cliché, aimed at quelling social, emotional, or cognitive unease. Platitudes have been criticized as giving a false impression of wisdom, making it easy to accept falsehoods. And here's the editorial part: a platitude is even worse than a cliché. I suppose you could love either or all. But in any case, there's a definition of platitude for you. Trite, meaningless, prosaic statement often used as a thought-terminating cliché. I think that's an important idea. Definition of wisdom from a slightly more established source, the Oxford English Dictionary: the ability to use your knowledge and experience to make good decisions and judgments. In this space, with us as a community, I've often used my favorite definition for wisdom, which is skill for living. So those ideas. Now, one of the most basic and, to me, useful field tests for whether what I'm listening to or reading leans more toward platitude or wisdom is to ask myself, if I reference this idea to history, does it resonate with themes or ideas that have consistently been regarded as wise? So a bit of a history litmus test to say, if this idea that I'm reading or that I'm listening to, if I take it and try to set it into a wider context of human reflection and human experience, does it resonate with other ideas and other experiences that history has been able to regard over time as representing wisdom? To put it another way, is it a generous enough idea to work in more than one setting or time or culture? And that's pretty important, because one of the ways we can easily ignore our own blind spots, our own prejudices, is by only testing ideas in the very limited sphere of our immediate sort of surrounding subcultures, and not doing the work of getting our head up and looking at a farther horizon. Another test that I find helpful is to ask, what happens to this idea, whatever idea it is, what happens to this idea if I imagined it amplified? What happens if I imagine this idea as bigger or more powerful or applied to life by more people or picked up by more people of influence? How does it behave? And here's where this comes back to the power of words, I think. I want to put these ideas into the context of two sacred texts from two different traditions. One is from the tradition of Buddhism and the other from the Christian tradition. I'm going to start with the Buddhist one because I don't know about you, but I find that if I start with something less familiar, I tend to encounter the ideas a little more, experience the ideas a little more acutely. They kind of break through my static a little bit more. One of the core collections of wisdom in Buddhism is commonly called the Five Precepts. There are a few of these sorts of kind of guiding sets of ideas that have accrued over time in Buddhism. At some point, I want to go through all of these and set them alongside Jesus' teachings, because it's a very fascinating study. Also, as you might expect from teachings that have been around for a long time, the edges of the precepts have sort of been rounded off, and they dovetail with one another in some pretty beautiful ways. We're going to lose some of the benefit of that strength of the precepts in the approach I'm going to use this morning, but I hope we'll be able to return to it another time. And the reason we're going to lose some of that benefit is because I'm not starting with precept one. I'm starting with precept number four. I'm just jumping right in the kind of a, you know, 2/3 of the way in, 4/5 of the way in, to be precise. The version that I'm going to reference of that precept is one that Thich Nhat Hanh has translated, this sort of late 20th century translation with contemporary issues in mind. So if you've encountered this precept with slightly different wording, then, well, first of all, you're paying pretty great attention to Buddhist texts and teachings. So, good on you for parsing that. But just so you know, this is a particular translation. Here's the precept, which in Thich Nhat Hanh's book, Living Buddha, Living Christ, comes under the header, Unmindful Speech Can Kill. Now, this is the precept. Aware of the suffering caused by unmindful speech and the inability to listen to others, I vow to cultivate loving speech and deep listening in order to bring joy and happiness to others and relieve others of their suffering. Relief of suffering and the ways in which our attachments cause our own suffering, of course, is one of the recurring and substantial themes of Buddhism. The precept goes on. Knowing that words can create happiness or suffering, I vow to learn to speak truthfully, with words that inspire self-confidence, joy, and hope. I am determined not to spread news that I do not know to be certain, and not to criticize or condemn things of which I am not sure. I will refrain from uttering words that can cause division or discord, or that can cause the family or community to break. I will make all efforts to reconcile and resolve all conflicts, however small. That's the precept. Wow. Thich Nhat Hanh goes on to say that in the Buddhist tradition, this precept is described in terms of engagement as refraining from four actions. From not telling the truth, which he describes as if it's black and you say it's white. Refraining from exaggerating, you make something up or you describe something as more beautiful than it actually is, or as ugly when it is not so ugly. Refrain from speaking with a forked tongue. You go to one person and say one thing, and then to another person and you say the opposite. And refraining from what Nhat Hanh calls filthy language, which he expands on by saying language that insults or abuses people. So, what happens if we apply our does this lean toward wisdom or platitude questions to that set of ideas? Well, they've certainly been enduring, so the history test is interesting. Buddhism has been around since the 6th century BCE, which makes it one of the oldest traditions still in practice today, considerably older, for example, than Christianity. And it continues to attract those that seek wisdom, and particularly those that seek wisdom as expressed through peace building and the practices of peace. The other question, what happens to those ideas if we amplify them? What happens if we imagine more people practicing them or people with more cultural power taking them seriously? Imagine a world leader aware that the suffering around them can be caused by unmindful speech and the inability to listen to others, and vowing to cultivate loving speech and deep listening in order to bring joy and happiness to others and relieve others of their suffering. Amplify that. Sounds pretty good. I think what happens in my imagination, at least, is that I end up imagining a world that operates pretty differently than the one that we're often surrounded by these days. And from my vantage point, you get a world that is much more a place in which the best of our shared humanity can thrive. Now, obviously, there's plenty more there we could explore. I'm not going to stop there today. In the interest of time, I want to offer one other text for our consideration. This is from the Christian tradition, probably the best known extended reflection on the power of words. It's found in the book of James, which tends to kind of toward the super practical consideration of what sorts of things build community and what sorts of things tear it down, and includes a section titled Taming the Tongue, which is followed directly by a section often called Two Kinds of Wisdom, which is an interesting one too already in light of our current exploration. I'm not going to read the entire section. If you want to look it up, it's in the third chapter of the book of James in the New Testament. I don't know if the author was a bit prone to speaking before thinking, if they were a bit of an off-the-cuff kind of person with some regrets in their wake. I don't know if they were in some science fiction-y way, you know, watching the 21st century evening news. But however it happens, the writer comes down rather heavily on the negative side of the power of speech, like someone maybe would if they've done a fair bit of damage with their own words and would like to have some of them back. As far as wisdom goes, you know, being aware of the damage we can do with our own words is important, of course. I mean, I feel like we're awash in illustrations of the destructive power of the tongue. That said, the same power is available for good. So let me just read a little section here from that text. By putting a bit into the mouth of a horse, we can turn the horse in different directions. It takes strong winds to move a large sailing ship, but the captain uses only a small rudder to make it go in any direction. Our tongues are small too, yet they brag about big things. I'm going to just stop there. I'm going to read a little bit more of it in a moment. But I took the time when I was studying this text this week to actually look up why a small rudder can turn a large ship. And because I thought, that's an interesting illustration. I mean, we've all sort of seen the reality of that, this little piece at the very back, and you change the angle of it, and a gigantic, freight liner, oil tanker, whatever, changes direction. Turns out that, I mean, James is talking about what he sees, of course. It's not being critical of the illustration as much as expanding it. That it's actually not the rudder that turns the ship. The rudder actually acts, in terms of engineering language for it. It creates an event, and that event acts on the way the ship's hull interacts with the force of the water around it. And essentially, it amplifies the force on one side of the ship and decreases the force on the other, sort of like what creates lift in an airplane wing, and the ship moves. So the rudder actually is a thing that starts something much bigger and much more powerful. And similarly with the horse's bit, you can, I don't know if you've ever had a chance to ride a horse that wanted to go a different direction than you. I have, and it's not a happy memory. You can pull on that bit until that horse's mouth bleeds. You could be vicious with it. And all you would turn is that horse's head. Its massive, powerful body would keep going in exactly the same direction unless it is responsive to that influence of the bit. So sort of like the rudder. So in some ways that doesn't decrease the power of the illustrations for me. It actually expands the power of those illustrations. And when it comes to the ways our words work, I think there's some deeply congruent truths there to pay attention to. Anyway, the last little bit of the part I wanted to read. It only takes a spark to start a forest fire. The tongue is like a spark, and here's the cloudy rather than the sunny version of that. It is an evil power that dirties the rest of the body and sets a person's entire life on fire with flames that come from hell itself. James, what did you say to the people around you that made you so afraid of your own power? To be fair to the text, at the end of that section, the writer acknowledges that both the sweet and the bitter can come from our own words. But they mostly seem appalled and perplexed by that complexity. In any case, the seems small but has a great impact point is, graphically illustrated for sure. Now, maybe there's an important piece of wisdom hiding in plain sight in that phrase, it only takes a spark to start a forest fire. It also only takes a spark to start a beacon fire. A fire that says, I can be found here and I need help. It only takes a spark to start a fire that keeps us from freezing to death. It only takes a spark to start a cooking fire. It only takes a spark to start a fire that speaks of the warmth and comfort of home, that says, you are welcome here at this fire. These things are also true. Like lots of things, maybe most notably things that are big and powerful but hard to pin down, things like love. The problem isn't in the power. The problem is in the way the power is used. To return to our earlier illustration, it's not the amplifier that's the issue. It's what's being amplified. Maybe we could think of it this way. The difference between wisdom and platitudes is 10,000 hours, which has sort of become that illustrative time block that suggests that's about how long it takes us as humans to become truly proficient at something. Platitudes we can toss off without very much thought. We can retweet without a lot of consideration, whether we're actually doing that in a platform that's labeled Twitter or whether we're just tweeting away. Wisdom, though, takes a lifetime of practice, actual hands-on practice in which we can acquire that thing that we might call skill for living. I was at this at the Justice for Black Lives rally on Friday. A number of us from the community were there, and I was really glad that that could happen for the people for whom it was possible. And I would suggest that picking up on some of what happened there, which is you can find online, is well worth some time spent. It was a fascinating experience. huge crowd. I think the organizers were surprised in terms of their equipping, perhaps, but also delighted with the turnout. And observations about generational mix taken into account, I was also fascinated by the racial mix, the diversity of that community. And I was struck by a couple of things. One is that it seems like there are a lot of people who were already fed up with the systemic racism that we are surrounded by and often blithe to. And the fact that we're starting to use a phrase like systemic takes us to certain places that are worth keeping in mind. I also heard someone say this week that the system isn't broken. The system is delivering exactly what it was designed to deliver, which is in itself a thought worthy of some reflection and examination. But one of the other things that struck me in that experience was the way that information traveled throughout the crowd. Sonically, we were close to the back, sort of on the Osborne side of the crowd, so straight downstream, so to speak, from the platform, but a ways away in the middle of the crowd, and you could hear the response of the crowd move through the crowd, like physically move through the crowd, and you could watch it happen around you. I found myself being quiet for much of the rally so that I could have that experience. That's true for all sorts of obvious physical reasons in terms of the way sound travels through space and the way we transmit things. But it's also a pretty powerful illustration of the way ideas move in culture. It's a pretty interesting embodiment of that reality and how our enactment in response to ideas is actually the essential piece that moves this from someone said something profound and moving and important that happened at the front and it happened over and over again to I heard that something in whatever environment, whether that's from a platform, a literal platform in front of me in a physical space or from a media platform. I heard that idea. I encountered that idea. I'm sorry, there's a microphone there that I just hit. If that was too loud, I apologize. It hit me. I encountered it in a way that took in all of me, including my body, and then I did something in response. When you're in the crowd, you can hear that response. You can hear the call Black Lives, and you can hear the response matter. You can hear the applause start at the front for an idea and ripple through the crowd until thousands of people are applauding, and it sounds like a rainstorm instead of like an individual or small group of hands clapping. All these sorts of things are this movement from I heard it, it went into my brain, it went into my body, and it became an action. I want to leave us there with this idea that wisdom is an acquired skill, and it takes practice. It takes a lifetime of practice. And like any practice, these things change over time. Wisdom is not the sort of skill I think that we acquire and then just repeat. Wisdom is a kind of skill that we never acquire in any terminal way, but that we keep moving into. A good friend of mine, singer-songwriter Steve Bell, put it this way in a recent post. And Steve's an activist, has long been involved most directly in Indigenous issues and Indigenous rights, and has embedded themselves and their family in that community in many ways that are pretty profound and meaningful for a person with settler heritage. Steve was at the rally as well. In any case, this response: could we, as a matter of discipline and thoughtful strategy, commit to match every social media post of outrage against systemic injustice with a tangible act of selfless love for someone outside of our own social group or comfort zone? And he offers it as a question. Could we? It's an interesting idea. He goes on to say this: of course we should protest injustice and inequity. But protest without love indeed, without the practice, is perhaps just more noise on an already noisy street. Not either or, both and. To me, that sounds like wisdom worth amplifying. Peace, everybody. It's been good to be with you, and I'll see you next week. Bye for now.